This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
It was code 99, the denial of death in Western society. And the reason that I titled that is because I think that in many ways, the idea of a code, and I don't know what number you are trying to use here, but where I worked was code 99. The idea of a code is a very interesting concept. The person is actually given a choice upon admission into a hospital, whether he wants to have a code status or to have a non-code status. And I think a lot of that stems, the dynamic and the decision, will often stem from an unpreparedness for death. And in many ways, I think that this culture is grossly underprepared for that final act that all of us will taste. The Quran literally says that every soul is tasting death, so that we are, by our nature, really death tasters. And this is, unfortunately, kind of, some people are still eating, so I hope I don't ruin your appetites. And that's another interesting point, is the way that we look at death, that it's an unpleasant topic that a lot of us don't like to speak about death. But I think there are very specific reasons, and I don't want to dwell on them for too long, of why this culture has become a death-denying culture. I don't think that that was always the case, but I also say that with an awareness that the fear of death is a universal fear. And certainly we have traces in all our historical traditions of this fear of death. In reality, it's actually a necessity to have some fear of death. If we did not have any fear of death, we would be literally in a very precarious situation. We would not look both ways when we walk across the street. And that would eventuate in our own death quite quickly. So the idea of a fear of death is actually a necessity. But also the idea of overcoming that fear in a positive way is a necessity in order for one to prepare for death. If we look at the condition, the present condition of human societies, it's been termed the postmodern period that we're in by philosophers. And the idea there is that there's no longer a grand narrative. There's no longer a meta-narrative by which we can live our lives. That prior to this period of time, people believed in some cosmological explanation of the universe. They had a cosmology which they could live believing in. And like Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said, if people have a why, they can endure any type of how. In other words, that when people have a purpose for existence, the pain and suffering that goes along with human existence is bearable. But when they lose that purpose of existence, that pain and suffering becomes unbearable. And in many ways, I think that this is an essential point to understand when we look at the extraordinary consumption of tranquilizers in our culture, of alcohol, of ways of literally subduing and suppressing the pain and suffering that people experience with daily existence. And ultimately, coming to terms with death is part of overcoming this pathological obsession with the pain and suffering that goes along with human existence. So in this postmodern world, what has happened is the scientific worldview, in a sense, has failed us. And this is being articulated by, and has been for some time, by philosophers on the continent, in the United States, and we really see it in many ways in the great failures of the rational period, the period of enlightenment, the promise of a human society in which rationalism, in which technology would solve our problems and would give us a reason and a purpose for continuing working towards this great utopian society that would come into existence at some future date. And this century alone has been called the century of mega-death. Over 180 million people have died at the hands of technological destruction in warfare in this century alone, which is a much greater number than all of the peoples that have died in previous wars prior to this century. And so literally, like Desjardins, the Christian philosopher, said that the fundamental question that all of us must answer in order to continue as a species is literally a choice between suicide or between adoration. And what he meant by that is either we give up the adoration which is inherent in the human nature to adore, or we literally commit suicide, either by technological means or by other means. One of the Archibald MacLeish said that the world ends when its metaphor has died. An age becomes an age all else beside, when sensuous poets in their pride invent emblems for the soul's consent that speak the meanings man will never know, but man imagined images can show. It perishes when those images, though seen, no longer mean. And what he's saying here basically is that people have a purpose. He uses the idea of a poet giving meaning to a culture in metaphors. And I would say that we could extend that also to the religious phenomenon that has existed in the human species since recorded history, certainly, and by all intents and purposes prior to that. That people have sensed a meaning of life. And when those meanings literally disappear, when the metaphors are no longer applicable, then we enter into a crisis. And the crisis of our age has been termed nihilism, or nihilism, which is the idea that we are in a meaningless universe. George Bernard Shaw in 1921 wrote that the Darwinian process may be described as a chapter of accidents. There is a hideous fatalism about it. If it be a truth of science, in other words, if the idea that everything exists because of chance, without purpose, if this is a scientific fact, then the stars of heaven, the showers of dew, and winter and summer, the fire and heat, the mountains and hills, may no longer be called to exalt the Lord with us by praise. Their work is to modify all things by blindly starving and murdering everything that is not lucky enough to survive the universal struggle for hogwash. And again, what he is really saying there is that if it is meaningless, then ultimately this is survival of the fittest, that whoever wins, and ultimately what they win is meaningless also. The religious vision is extremely an incredible departure from this idea. And I know that many of the people here are scientists, are men of science, women of science, people that have studied the scientific worldview. And I don't know how many in the room are content with the scientific worldview as an ultimate answer. Because I think part of the problem with modern science is that it deals with the hows of existence, but it never deals with the whys. It tells us how things happen. It tells us how things come about, either through wonderful theories or through empirical observation of facts collated by scientists that are then placed into worldviews, scientific paradigms. And the paradigms will hold as long as the theory is not supplanted by another theory that better explains the facts. So all of us, as people that have either studied extensively or in a limited sense science, all of us, particularly in the West, have in some way placed an absoluteness in science, in modern science. In the same way that people prior to this civilization placed an absoluteness in theology, in the religious worldview. Now, for many people, the scientific worldview is because of its obsession with how, and its really lack of emphasis of why, is really not a fulfilling worldview. It does not give us a sustenance whereby we can live our lives with a sense of meaning and purpose. Now, there are different ways of dealing with that fact, this emptiness or this vacuum that exists. I think one of the most common ways is literally choosing to die before our bodily death. And that is what's been termed a psychological death. I'd like to go to the first. In looking at dying and the idea of dying, we can see basically that there are five reasons why people really have an intense fear of death. Fear of pain is certainly in consideration, and you can see this in people that are working with people in pain, that they really want to be alleviated of their pain. Now, we're looking at a bodily level, but also there's a emotional pain that's connected with death and dying. The idea of fear of loss, that there is a separation. And separation is a pain. We can see it in children when they're separated from the mother. There's an experience of pain. They'll often cry. That is a very real pain for the child. There's also a fear of meaninglessness, that the idea of death, that if we die, that we no longer have purpose. We no longer have meaning. We're not loved anymore. And this, in a sense, can bring about a feeling of failure. Also, the idea of the fear of the unknown. That death, although we see it constantly, it literally surrounds us in our lives, either in an immediate sense, with the death of close people to us, or in a distant sense. But death really surrounds us in nature and in our own selves. And then finally, the idea of fear of non-being. The idea that we will ultimately not exist. That this is very frightening for people. And you can go to the next one. We're really relieved to keep everybody. You can get a lot of the philosophical problems of life answered by just reading the comments. This one here is good grief trapped in a doghouse by an icicle. I'll bet if I make just the slightest move, it'll crash down and kill me. I don't want to die. I'm too young to die. I'm too nice to die. I'm too me to die. In other words, the death of the ego, the idea that this formulation of who we are, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I'm Professor So-and-so, I'm the wife of so-and-so, this attachment to who we are in something that really, ultimately, has no permanency whatsoever. And the finest example I can see of it is Alzheimer's disease. Is literally when the consciousness is effaced from the intellect. When a person literally no longer has any awareness in a conscious way of who he was, of who his loved ones are. Tragic disease, but ultimately a beautiful metaphor also for the nature of ego and the nature of consciousness. So we can move to the next. These are just some examples of really the idea of death denial in our culture. Just euphemisms we use for death: kick the bucket, succumb. Wasted, checked out, eternal rest, laid to rest, pushing up daisies, was a goner, withered away in the arms of the Father, gave it up, it was curtains, bit the dust, resting in peace. All of these ways in which we euphemistically describe death. The word is almost literally not brought up in polite company. And when we speak about death, when we speak about people that died, we tend to use these euphemisms. We don't like to really just look at the bare bones of the matter. Just look at the fact that somebody has died. And so there... You can move to the next. Looking at the idea of physical death, according to the Harvard Medical School's and I think these are the guidelines that are being nationally used, about actually what determines death. And fascinating for me in the hospitals that nurses can't really say whether a patient's dead or not. We need a doctor to come in and declare death. And the idea that death is a death of brain activity, we do check the brain waves if they're no longer there, the heart and blood, the circulatory system, that the heart has stopped. Death of the nervous system, that we don't get any reflexive responses from the individual, and then the death of the breath, the lungs, that there's no longer any breath. Now, if we look at psychological death, I think that there's a definite correlation here. If we look at the death of brainwaves, psychologically, this is what can be termed as a cognitive death. that people literally die, they stop thinking, like dead at 25, buried at 75. And there are a lot of people that literally choose to stop thinking in their lives, to stop reflecting. Now, I personally think part of the problem of modern society is that we are overdosed with reality. T.S. Eliot said that human beings cannot take too much of reality. It's something that literally overwhelms us. And one of the ways of dealing with this overdose of reality is literally to die a psychological death, to become numb to the experience of life. When we are literally living in a country where some of us are enjoying extraordinary fruits, the quote-unquote American dream, and yet we see on the news areas of the earth that are literally ravaged by war, by hunger, by poverty, by suffering that is really beyond our imagination at this point in time unless we've been in that situation. So to watch that on television, to see this day in and day out, to recognize that while some of us live in wonderful environments, there are others that live and really close to us, not that far away, that is a very numbing experience for many people. And so they choose to move into a psychological death. The next one, the heart of blood, is a type of emotional death where people become dead to their emotions. They have no awareness of their feelings. They lose touch with how they are experiencing life. And this happens in human relationships between males and females. A man and a wife that really die to each other. There is an emotional death, and there can be a cognitive death. And then the death of the nervous system psychologically is the volitional death, when we literally move into the routinization, perfunctory performance of our lives, where literally, and this is sometimes termed as burnout, which is particularly high in the healthcare profession, that people literally become burned out. They go through the motions. Whatever that fire was that initiated their journey in the beginning is now quite literally burnt out. And they no longer have that flame that keeps them going, that keeps them moving. And then finally, the breath in the lungs is psychologically the intuitive paralysis, that we no longer have insight. We no longer literally perceive. What is the meaning of events? What is the meaning of our lives? What do these things mean in the context of life itself? Now, you can see also in Kubler-Ross's stages that the first one is similar to bargaining, and then the second is similar to anger, third, depression, fourth, denial. That is not her. Her stages go, actually, the first is usually denial, and then anger, and then depression, and then bargaining, and then acceptance. And bargaining is a fascinating attempt that people, like the man who was literally being pulled out by the tide, and he said, "Oh God, please, if you just send me a wave, I'll dedicate my whole life to you." And a wave comes, and as he's getting closer to shore, he says, "I'll dedicate half my life." And then he gets a little closer, and he says, "One third." And by the time he gets back to the shore, he decides he's going to put some charity into the box on Sunday. So we do really bargain constantly, in a sense, whether we believe in God or not. I mean, people do bargain. There are many psychological bargainings going on. The idea of denial, which is really what is so fascinating about the human species, that despite the fact that death surrounds us, we do remain in a state of denial, is rather frightening. The next one. This is another way of looking at it: brain thinking, heart feeling, central nervous system sensation, and breath, intuition, and then the next one. Now, this is the death that I think is the fascinating death. And this is the death that every single spiritual tradition, whether it be Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity in its more mystical traditions, Judaism, and Islam, and which is what I've come to emphasize, is the spiritual death. The idea of the spiritual death is literally coming to terms with the fact that we are mortal, that we are ephemeral creatures, that we will die, and to recognize that our suffering is bound to this artificial sense of who we are, our attachment to the ego itself. If you look in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha said his first truth was that the world was suffering. His second truth was that the cause of suffering was desire. And what he meant there was that literally the cause of the suffering that exists in the world is our attachment to the world, our attachment to the idea of the self, to the idea of fame, to the idea of power, to the idea of all of these things. In the Islamic tradition, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that human beings are asleep, and when they die, they wake up. And he said, die before you die. And you will find this tradition in many different spiritual traditions. The idea of dying before you die is dying the death of meaning before the death of sensory comes to you. One of the Persian poets, Shebestari, said in an extraordinary poem, which is called Roshan Firaz, if you wish to understand this meaning, and what he's talking about is really life itself, reflect on how existence is both death and life. Everything in the cosmos, terrestrial and celestial, has an example which is visible in your body and spirit. The cosmos, like you, is a specific person. You are as a spirit to it, and it is your body. Man dies in three different ways. The first death occurs in every breath because of his nature. And really, this is the idea of death and regeneration that's taking place in our bodies. And as people that have studied anatomy and physiology, I mean, we recognize this, that death is literally taking place. Cells are dying constantly in the body and being reborn. And part of taking in breath is literally for the regeneration of the cells themselves. So there is death and rebirth in every instant. So this is the first death. The second death is the death of choice, which is the spiritual death. The third is the death which is inevitable for him. Since death and life are opposites, his life is of three kinds and in three degrees. The cosmos has no death by choice, as you alone of all creation possess this. What the German philosopher Heidegger said was that everything perishes, but only the human being alone has demise. In other words, that we are literally the only creature that has a death that is conscious, that we are literally consciously aware of the act of dying. And the spiritual death is literally using exercises, death exercises, to arrive at a state of the death of the self. If you look at, for instance, in the Islamic tradition, the Hajj, the pilgrimage that Muslims make, and are encouraged to make as soon as possible, the Hajj is literally a dress rehearsal for death. The person takes care of all of their debts, all of their worldly responsibilities, writes their will if they haven't done it prior to that, says goodbye to their friends as if they don't expect to come back, goes to Mecca, circumambulates the house there, which is an empty square, in literally the garment that they will be buried in a death garment, a white cloth that has no threads in it and has no distinction of personality or fame. Everybody is equalized during this pilgrimage. And then they move between two places, literally running back and forth, which is symbolic of our state in the world, of moving back in a state of confusion. And the finality of the Hajj is to stand on what's known as the plane of gnosis, or knowledge, to stand as if you are standing on the day of resurrection. This is a spiritual exercise to come to terms with our death. When the person comes back, they should have come back as if they have died. In other words, they are literally ready to go back to their Lord. And so this idea of death acceptance, which really is in every tradition, we find this in all of the traditions. But in the Islamic tradition, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said make mention of death at least 20 times in a day. His idea there is not to become morbidly fixated on death. The idea is not to become, to wear black and to literally become somebody that is obsessed with the ultimate reality of death. No, it is to be literally a liberation from the chains of psychological death, from the chains of the routinization of the world, so that life literally becomes the experience of the moment. If you literally leave your house, not expecting to return in the evening, how will you leave your spouse? How will you leave your children? If with each meeting, when you depart, with a recognition of death, how will that departure be? The intensity of life will be so enhanced that literally you will begin to become alive. And that is why the spiritual death is literally the rebirth of the soul. In the same way that the physical death is the rebirth of the soul, the spiritual death in this world, the death acceptance that takes place, becomes an opportunity whereby life becomes meaningful in each moment. And this is a challenge. It's not something that is easily acquired. And I don't think it's something that can be artificially created. It's literally a very real cognitive experience of the temporality of death. In the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha said that the most important meditation is the meditation of death. And in that tradition, the only permission that was given traditionally by Japanese Zen masters to meditate without permission was the meditation of death and of compassion. And ultimately, when you begin to accept death, compassion becomes increased. Compassion towards our fellow human beings becomes increased. This is from a physicist who talked about the order in existence. And he looked at it from a physical perspective of the idea of this pulsation that begins. And it's very interesting that as it moves out, the waves get bigger and ultimately end up in what we call explicate order, which is the world of the seeing of human beings. Of all of this matter that we see formulated, and yet physicists tell us that it's really, this is not its real essence, that it's really actually energy moving at incredibly high speeds, but somehow brought together because of the density of the field. As you move down, what's fascinating is in physics, the power increases. As the wave, the peak and the trough of the wave in quantum mechanics becomes smaller, power literally increases. But at a certain point, the wave has to stop. At a certain point, there's nothing beyond that. In other words, there's nothing physical. And this is only, at that point, we arrive to an area of speculation. What is the source of the emanation? Where is this coming from? What is the source of the emanation? Why is there being and not non-being? Why are we here as opposed to not being here? And this is the question that must be asked ultimately in order to come to terms with our own finality, with our own deaths. And I think as people, as physicians, and people working with people that are literally, although in reality the Quran says that God is closer to you than your jugular vein. It actually says your carotid artery, it's transited as jugular vein. that God is closer to you than your carotid artery. The idea that God is closer to us than our own source of consciousness, which is the flow of the blood to the brain. If that stopped, then consciousness stopped. So this nearness of God is also a nearness of our own death. The Prophet Muhammad said that death is closer to you than the strap on your sandal. That it's literally part of our being. And coming to terms with that reality, that we are finite creatures, is coming to terms with the most essential and important question that we are confronted with as human beings, which is, why are we here? And ultimately, there are two choices. That this is random, that it's meaningless, or that no, there is purpose in existence. And this is a problematic question in the 20th century, moving on to the 21st century. For many people, this is problematic. And there are many very strong and valid reasons for the difficulty of this. And this is the choice that we make, of whether we accept a universe that has purpose and meaning. If we do, then death has meaning. Death is not meaningless. There is no arbitrariness in existence. There is no chance. Like Einstein said, God does not play dice with the universe. This is from the Quran, is an account of creation. It says, oh humankind, if you have doubt about the resurrection, that you will be brought forth, that you will literally be recreated, if you have doubt about the resurrection, consider that we created you out of dust. Then, in other words, the human being literally comes from the earth. It says in the Quran that we brought you forth from the earth, using words like vegetation. The human being comes, and we have all of the constituents that exist in earth also within our own bodies. The sodium, the potassium, all the different, the zinc, and the trace metals. Out of dust, then out of sperm, and then out of a leech-like clot. And the word in Arabic for the leech-like clot is alaq, which means a lump that clings, which is when there's insemination of the sperm with the ovum, when we get the zygote, it literally clings to the womb, like a leech. It clings to the side of the womb that has been prepared by the woman through the cycle. Then out of a morsel of flesh, which is mutqa, which it literally means like a morsel. In other words, that at a certain point when the spinal cord begins to differentiate, if you look under a microscope at the fetus, it literally looks like a chewed piece of flesh. And Dr. Keith Moore, whose textbook is used in several universities in embryology, makes mention of the Quranic version, that it is actually an extremely exact description of what's taking place in at a microscopic level in the womb. Partly formed and partly unformed, because we see as the fetus begins to differentiate, there are areas that are formed and areas that are unformed. In order that we may manifest our power to you, and R is similar to the royal we in English, and we cause whom we will to rest in the wombs for an appointed term, then do we bring you out as babes, then foster you that you may reach your age of full strength. And some of you are called to die before that. And some are sent back to the feeblest of old age, where you literally go back to the childlike state. And in our culture, literally wearing diapers, having no cognitive awareness, becoming like a child. So that they know nothing after having known much. And this is all to indicate the power of the Creator, that no matter how marvelous we become as intellectuals, as scientists, as people of thought, we will ultimately be reduced to dust. And this is perhaps the most humbling aspect of human existence that we can reflect on. The idea of accepting death and its importance. Some of the wonderful Muslim poets who were men of, and women of deep knowledge and reflection have described death. One Persian poet says, "Our death is our wedding with eternity." The death literally is a wedding with eternity. What is the secret? God is one. The sun divides itself, streaming through the different openings of the house, but when these openings are closed, multiplicity vanishes. And what he's saying there, he's using the sun as a metaphor to describe divine unity. And this goes back to that earlier frame about this, where are these waves emanating from? The waves are not the source, in the same way that the photon is not the sun. The light particle or the light wave is not the sun, and yet it emanates from the sun. And just as the sun is a unified sphere, these parts that differentiate from the sun, when the door is closed, multiplicity vanishes. In other words, when the door is closed and the light of the sun is gone, we return back to that darkness, which is symbolic of unity. And what he's saying there is that when death comes, then we recognize the truth of God is one. And really, every tradition, and even the Hindu tradition itself, has an understanding of the divine unity. Every single tradition, whether you look at Buddhism, at Judaism, at Christianity, at Taoism, there is an understanding of the underlying unity, which is the substrata. And that's a bad word, but is literally is the basis by which existence can come about, the multiplicity of existence. There's an interesting philosopher, Mainlader, who's a German, who wrote a book in which he actually was the first one to use the idea of God is dead. And what he meant by that, prior to Nietzsche, what he meant by that was something very different from what it became to be used. He meant literally that as long as we exist in the world of multiplicity, God is dead to us. And God only becomes alive experientially when we recognize that the divine unity is truth and multiplicity is only a temporal experience. And so this is what he's talking about. Dying literally is a wedding with eternity. In another poem he says, his name is Jalaluddin Rumi, he says, "Everything you see has its roots in the unseen world. In the same way that you can see a tree over the earth, by knowledge and reflection we know that that tree ultimately has roots." What he's indicating here is that when we see phenomenal existence, if we're people of discernment, then we must recognize that there's an unseen source from it. And to say that it's the quantum world is still limiting us to a physical reality. The forms may change, yet the essence remains the same. Every wonderful sight will vanish. Every sweet word will fade. But do not be disheartened. All of the delights of the world that we experience, they'll all go. But do not be disheartened. The source they come from is eternal, branching out, giving new life and new joy. Why do you weep? The source is within you. You can know this reality. And this whole world is springing up from it. The source is full and its waters are ever flowing. Do not grieve. Drink your fill. Do not think it will ever run dry. This is the endless ocean. From the moment you came into this world, a ladder was placed in front of you that you might transcend it, the world itself. From earth you became plant, from plant you became animal, afterwards you became a human being endowed with knowledge, intellect, and faith. Behold the body born of dust, how perfect it has become. Why should you fear its end? When were you ever made less by dying? When you pass beyond this human form, no doubt you will become a spirit and soar through the heavens, but don't stop there. Even heavenly bodies grow old. Pass again from the heavenly realm and plunged into the vast ocean of consciousness, let the drop of water that is you become 100 mighty seas. The Quran reminds human beings constantly, and it's read, and it's wonderfully, there's this constant return to this theme of the returning to God, that to God you will return. And what every religious tradition teaches is the idea of surrender, of submission. And this is the meaning of Islam, literally, is to submit, to surrender. To come to terms with your finality, to recognize that you are a responsible human being, that there is an urgency and a sense of responsibility. Coming to terms with this and with our death. I'm going to end this with a poem, which is the funeral poem of the same man who wrote the other poem. And he said it right before he died to his son, who was a scholar in his own right. Go to your pillow and sleep, my son. Leave me alone in the passion of this death night. Let the mill turn with your breathing, but stay clear. Don't fall into the river with me. There's no way out, no cure but death. Last night in a dream, I saw an old man standing in a garden. It was all love. He held out his hand and said, come toward me. If there is a dragon on this path, that old man has the emerald face that can deflect it. This is enough. I am leaving myself. Bahauddin, that's his son's name. Bahauddin, my son, if you want to be impressively learned, memorize a famous historian and quote him as someone else. So he's warning him about the idea of fame and being attached to yourself. On the day I die, when I'm being carried towards the grave, don't weep. Don't say, he's gone, he's gone. Death has nothing to do with going away. The sun sets and the moon sets, but they're not gone. Death is a coming together. The tomb looks like a prison, but it's really release. The human seed goes down in the ground like a bucket into the well where Joseph was. It grows and comes up full of some unimagined beauty. Your mouth closes here and immediately opens with a shout of joy there. This is the vision of somebody who really has come to terms with death and with dying. And I would liken our society to children in its attitude towards death and dying. Just like we must learn to eat, and if you see a grown man come to the table and literally start with his hands shoving his food into his mouth and the food dripping all over his clothes, and then when there's no more, start banging on the table and screaming for more, you would say, this is an infantile man, that he should have learned to eat like a human being. Why is he still eating like a baby eats? In the same way that we have to learn how to do those bodily functions properly. We have to learn to eat. We have to be socialized into behavior. What our religious traditions and what Islam is teaching us is that we have to learn how to die. Not to die like babies, screaming. And I've seen it in my own limited hospital experience. People literally not ready to die. I was in, and all of you have many experiences, I'm sure, but I was in a code which really wanted me to just completely leave the hospital situation. About an 82-year-old woman that went on for about 20 minutes. And if we're not ready to die by the time we get to 82, something very seriously wrong with our society's view of death and what death means. And I think, unfortunately, because we've separated our spiritual selves so much from our emotional and our physical selves, that we literally have become embarrassed in dealing with the issue and the spiritual implications of our deaths and the termination of our lives. And I hope that in some way I've just maybe given you some insights that are useful to you, and I'm sure a lot of this was just a reminder. And I would just like to say that I thank you very much for inviting me to speak here, and welcome any comments or questions.